All right. Thank you, sir. All right. We're going to be looking at Psalm 11. If you want to be turning your Bibles there, if you're not already there. We've enjoyed studying the Psalms the past, I think, 3 Sundays here in a row. So I thought I'd keep that train going a little bit longer. We've looked at Psalm 34, which kind of gives a historical context to it. Looking when David kind of feigned a madman before the king of Gath. Not a smart move on his part to be there in the first place. How he depended on the Lord in that situation. And then we looked at Psalm 90 last Sunday night. Help us to count our days. So today we're going to look at Psalm 11. And it's one that doesn't have a historical context given to it. Although I think, and we'll kind of look at this together, but this psalm may be written about the time when David was fleeing from Saul. It's a psalm of David, and maybe it's a reflection of kind of that time period in his life. So we'll look at a little bit of that when we get there. But if you think about that time in David's life, you can just imagine how stressful that time would have been with King Saul, with his 3,000 chosen men just searching for David night and day. And that was priority number one on Saul's to-do list, is to get rid of David and secure the kingship for his son, who was also David's best friend, Jonathan. So he was just kind of running around everywhere in Judah, in the Negev, in the southern part of the land, and just kind of see his dependence on the Lord, although he did have a couple of hiccups along the way. But I think we'll notice kind of that theme going throughout this psalm. So why don't we just go ahead and jump right into it? And verse 1, kind of the first line there, is really the summary of the entire psalm. So it just says, "In the Lord I take refuge." He is going to be pointing to why he takes refuge in the Lord as we go through this psalm. But that is his opening statement. That's what this entire psalm is all about. So we just see David right away putting his confidence, putting his trust in the Lord. So David is just stressing the point to his audience that the Lord is the one that he puts his security in. In the Lord I take refuge. So even the structure of the sentence, I'm not a Hebrew scholar, that may surprise some of you, but what I read about that is even the way it's written, in the Lord I take refuge, it kind of stresses the first part of that, the Lord. So it may be a little bit different in saying, I take refuge in the Lord. So just kind of the first part of that, he's emphasizing it's the Lord. So we'll see that throughout this psalm. So during a very hard and stressful time in his life, David has found, if you want to take refuge, if you want to put your trust in something, the Lord is your best option. Now, there are a lot of alternatives to putting your refuge in that are not as good, and you could probably come up with some of those things that people take their refuge in, their money, their strength, their wisdom, their might. For David, it's it's always going to be the Lord. So that's kind of the opening statement. And then in kind of the latter part of verse 1 into verse 3 is we're going to look at what people are encouraging David to do. So you have these outsiders kind of trying to influence David. This is what you should do. Right after he makes that statement, in the Lord I take my refuge. So let's see if we can figure out what they are trying to encourage David to do. Looking at the rest of verse 1 in through 3. So we'll read it again. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They have fitted their arrow to the string to shoot in the dark at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? All right, so you have the people saying, how can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? So this is the temptation that all of us face. Are we going to put our trust in the Lord, or are we going to flee to our mountain, whatever that mountain may be? And you can think of times where men were encouraged to basically the idea of flee to their mountain. Put your trust in something other than God. So I'll just give you a couple that I came up with. Remember in Nehemiah chapter 6, where the person was trying to get Nehemiah in trouble, and he said, why don't you are under attack, why don't you come into the temple as your sanctuary, as your safeguard? Only problem with that is Nehemiah was not a priest, therefore was not allowed in the temple. So you have kind of someone disguising themselves as trying to help Nehemiah in that case. Why don't you flee to the temple? You have Job's wife, who sees the great agony and pain that her husband is in, and basically tells him, why don't you just give up and get this over with and die, curse the Lord and die? Why don't you just do it that way instead of keep trusting in the Lord? That's kind of foolish. Another one maybe Jesus and Satan. Remember when he gets baptized, and then the Spirit leads him to the wilderness. And then after 40 days, Satan says, you have never performed a miracle before. Why don't you prove yourself by turning these stones into bread? Why don't you kind of help yourself? Kind of use miracles to your advantage and have some bread since you are dying of hunger. Remember Peter to Jesus when he said, after Jesus said, I'm going to die on the cross. And Peter said, by no means am I going to let you do that. And he said, get behind me, Satan. David's men, kind of bringing it full circle here, with his two opportunities to kill Saul, and they said, hey, here is your opportunity to get rid of your enemy, just as the Lord has said, he's given him into your hands. Why don't you kill him, and you won't have to be on the run anymore, and that will make your life so much easier, and then you can go on to be the next king as you were anointed to be. So sometimes in life, we will be given options to kind of in figuratively speaking, why don't you flee to your mountain? Why don't you do things your way, or the way that I'm thinking, and not trust in the Lord? And so that's the really the pivotal question that David is faced with. And notice how they ask that, kind of the emphasis there. How can you say to my soul? How can you say to my soul to do this? It's as though David is just really frustrated with them for even asking this kind of a question. How can you even say something like that? Is how it comes across. So when things get tough, when things get hard, and if this is indeed talking about David's life, fleeing from Saul or a difficulty in his life, and then saying, why don't you flee to your own mountain instead of just keep trusting in the Lord? Well, when life gets tough, that is really, that's the perfect time to flee to the Lord, to go to him. And instead of the other way around, when things get tough, try to do things on your own and by your own wit, might, strength. No, that's foolish. So David says, how in the world can you ask my soul, the deepest part of me, to give up on the Lord and flee to my own mountain? So really, it's kind of what I'm trying to say is either we make God our refuge or we try to make our own refuge. So it is, someone has stated this, if it's difficult with the Lord, think about how difficult it would be without the Lord. So that's a kind of a nice sentiment, just kind of getting across the point of you need the Lord, especially when it's difficult. Second Samuel, chapter 12 and verse 7, and this is in the context, chapter 11 is when he sins with Bathsheba, kills Uriah, the Hittite, and then chapter 12, Nathan goes to him and says, you are the man, and then starting kind of there, 6, 7, he states, this is what God was going to do for you. And so verse 7 talks about what he did for David in the past. God says, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. So God is the one that takes credit for that, and rightly so, because he's the one that did it. So don't think it was David's ability to kind of escape from Saul. It was the Lord blessing him through that. So since David took refuge in the Lord, this is what the Lord did for him. He was able to keep him safe, or as it says, delivered him from the hand of Saul. So that's really kind of the key question in this. Are you going to take refuge in the Lord? Or are you going to flee to your own mountain? So we haven't got to verses 2 and 3 yet, but any thoughts or comments just on that idea in verse 1?
It's interesting that Mount Zion was called the city of David. So it's kind of ironic because here's David talking about the mountains, and Mount Zion was where his house was built. And so maybe there's some dual meanings here. If you look up a mountain in the scriptures, it has some interesting connotations. The mountain of the Lord is spoken about. And Micah says the mountains will melt under him. Isaiah said the mountains will quake at his presence. And yet we also see mounts as good places where the Lord did his work, like Mount Tabor, Mount Carmel.
Yes, and also maybe what comes to mind is Isaiah chapter 2, where they are going up to the mountain and people saying, why don't you come with us? Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, so forth and so on. That's Isaiah 2, 1 through 4 primarily. But yeah, maybe there is kind of a dual meaning that the Lord is his mountain. So if you think about it in that way, which mountain would you rather go to? The Lord's mountain or your puny little mountain? So maybe that's an idea there too. Any other thoughts? Well, looking at verse 2 and 3, they are asking the question, what can the righteous do? Well, you see it at the very end of verse 3. So if the foundations are destroyed, what in the world can the righteous do? So you have the idea, the verse 1, flee like a bird to the mountain. Because they have arrows ready to shoot. So you need to flee like a bird and get out of here. So they have bows bent. In other words, they are ready to just pull the trigger. They are using the righteous as target practice. You could think of that. These men are looking at the wicked, and they are afraid of what could happen to David. So they are saying, if you're smart, you're going to flee to the mountain. So I want us to notice their mindset. Why are they afraid? They are afraid for David because they are looking at the wicked and what the wicked are doing instead of who is on David's side. So the more we concentrate on the world around us and the less we concentrate on the Lord, the more likely we're going to go to our mountain. That makes sense? So even the idea here, someone trying to encourage David, if you're smart, you know, look at what the wicked are doing. They're after you. They're about to kill you. Go to the mountain. And he says, why in the world would you ask such a silly question? So David is asking, really telling him, you're asking the wrong question. And instead of saying, look at what the wicked can do, instead you should be seeing, look what God can do. And you shouldn't worry about these bent bows and so forth and so on. So the righteous can always serve the Lord and can always rely on the Lord. So you may think of different applications to this, of someone saying, why don't you do it your own way, flee to your mountain instead of to the Lord. Some text in the Bible. Some say, well, don't teach on that because we have some people in the congregation that, you would be stepping all over their toes on that. And so it's better to just kind of avoid that topic. Well, are you going to trust in that or are you just going to preach God's word and let it do its work? In the thought of Peter and Jesus when he says, I'm gonna do everything I can to save you from the cross. People have sometimes good intentions. They want what's best for us, but they're not putting God's will first. So may we always put God first instead of relying on our own thoughts or wits, strength, so forth and so on. I think I bring this up later, but you can kind of think of the idea of Peter when he was walking on the water. And then what happened? It says he looked at the waves and the wind, And then he became scared, and then he began to sink. So as long as he was focusing on Jesus, he was okay. But how often we focus our attention off of Jesus, and we get worried about the things around us, and then we begin to sink because we begin to trust in our own mountain. I was going to bring up just this idea in David's life, and you can see how he learned this principle, and how he can just confidently say, why in the world would you want me to flee to my own mountain? Because that doesn't work. So if you think of David at the very beginning, when we're kind of first introduced to him, 1 Samuel, really chapter 17 is what I'm referencing with him and Goliath. What was his attitude in that? It was not, I think I can get this guy. It was, I know this guy can whoop me, but he is blaspheming the God of heaven. And so I don't need to stand for that. And it's not I who is going to win this victory, but it is the Lord who is going to win this victory. And so you see him putting his faith in the Lord and coming out victorious. And then things begin to go pretty well for him. He goes out in battle. He's very successful. And King Saul seems to figure out this guy's going to be the next king. So he tries to kill David. But David just keeps trusting in the Lord. And then he finally has to flee from his house and be on the run. And that's when he starts to get in trouble. So this is a instance where David fled to his mountain, so to say. So remember when he flees and Saul is after him and he goes to Nob, the city of the priest. And he goes there, and then the priest asks him, what are you doing here? Kind of gets the priest all worried. And remember what David said. He says, one, there is only a step between me and death. Now, is that true? You could probably answer either way and be right. But remember, God had promised David, you're going to be the next king. So would David or God allow David to die? Well, no, right? But you have David thinking, I need to kind of do things on my own because there's only a step between me and death. So he flees to Nob. And then they ask him, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm on a secret mission from Saul. Now, what would we call that? I would call that a lie. Because he was not on a secret mission from Saul. He was on a mission to get away from Saul. And so he lies. And then he proceeds to eat the showbread, which Jesus says that was only for the priest. So you just see these bad decisions kind of dominoing on top of each other. And then the last thing he does at that city is, do you have any weapons? And they say, well, we have Goliath's sword with us, and says, great, I'll take that. That's a pretty good sword. So you just see this idea of David kind of relying on himself instead of the Lord. And then he flees to Gath, where Goliath was from. That was smart, right? And then he feigns madness. We already looked at that, Psalm 34. God delivers him out of that. And in the meantime, Saul goes to Nob and kills 85 priests. And one priest, Abiathar, was the only son of Ahimelech, the priest, to escape alive from that city, and he flees to David. And what's interesting is 1 Samuel 22:22, and it says, David said, I have brought the death of every person in your father's household. That's interesting that David would say, I have brought the death of every person in your father's household. He takes the blame for that. Why? Well, it's because he was depending on himself instead of depending on the Lord. So then he switches. He says, all right, I need to depend on the Lord. Instead of doing things my way, that didn't go so well. And remember him saving the city of Keilah because Saul wasn't doing his job as king. And he asked God, should I do this? Should I go save this city from the Philistines? God says, yeah, go ahead and do that. He does that. Saul had at one point David surrounded on the mountain. And it just so happens, right, that Saul gets a message that the Philistines are attacking the land. And so Saul flees and goes and attack the Philistines, or kind of protect his people from the Philistines. So just again and again, you see God protecting David. And then there's one more reference. I know I'm giving you basically the book of 1 Samuel here, but there's one more reference, and this is almost the saddest story of David's life, where again, he attempts to flee to his own mountain. And that's chapter 27 and 29 of 1 Samuel. So we'll run through this real quick. So after sparing Saul for the second time, this is what he said to himself. And see if this sounds familiar from before. Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me any more in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand. That's chapter 27, verse 1. So again, you have David kind of taking it on himself to, there's only a step between me and death, kind of like what he said before. I need to flee to the Philistines and be protected kind of in their territory, so Saul won't find me and kill me one day. So the rest of the story, David flees. I don't know why he loves the city of Gath so much, but that's where he goes. And he meets King Achish. And basically he gets a deal with Achish to live in a certain territory of that land. And he lives there for a year and 4 months, which is a really long time given what David was doing. So David would raid the enemies of Israel. And you can read that in chapter 27. And he would make sure that no one escaped, so that if someone escaped, they would go tell Achish what he was doing. So he would make his raid, kind of protecting his people, then go back. And then Achish would say, oh, where have you made a raid today? And says, oh, man, I've been just beating on those people in Judah, which I would also call a lie, right? So again, you have David depending on his own wits. And so Achish believes him. And he said, man, David is making himself odious towards his own people. He is really come to our side on this. And he's really being a strong proponent for us Philistines. Well, he gets in trouble. Everything was going just fine up until the Philistines had a war with Israel. And so what does Achish want to do? Hey, I'll bring my number one squad, David and his men. And man, he's been beaten up on Judah for a year and 4 months now. Let's bring him on to let him do it again And so he brings David, or he invites David along to fight Israel. And so now you're David, and you're like, I can't really say no to this, right? Because I've led him along for this long. And then God blesses him, merciful, whatever that word is, extends mercy to David, and says, we don't want that guy with us. He's going to turn on us. He was the guy that killed Goliath, and, you know, he killed Saul the thousands and David the 10,000s. There's no way we're going to let him come to battle. Well, David, you know, kind of picture yourself as David in this situation. He has to kind of save his face here. So what is he going to say? Well, what he does say in chapter 29, verse 8, to Achish, after really hearing what he wants to hear, that you're not allowed to fight, whew, good. David says, but what have I done? And what have you found in your servant this day, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? Talking about Achish. So David is trying to convince Achish again, you know, look, what have I done? I've only been good to you. And so again, David learns, sometimes the hard way, never flee to your mountain. Always trust in the Lord. Because when you start doing things your way and by your own wit and might, boy, things get bad very quickly. Proverbs 3 comes to mind. You've probably been thinking about this. It's chapter 3, verses 5 through 7, where it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. I think that's where we get tripped up so often, and we become wise in our own eyes. And we think, well, I know a better way to handle this, instead of taking refuge in the Lord and letting him handle the things that come up in your life. All right. Any thoughts or comments through verse 3? Thoughts you may have had? All right. Time is up. So we'll move on to verse 4. Where we see this as basically David's response. So 1 through 3, this is what you need to do, David. Flee to your mountain. And, you know, what can the righteous do? Well, this is David's response for 4 through 7. And I've kind of broken this section down as 5 answers that David gives to his, what do we want to call him? His people that are trying to encourage him to do the wrong thing in verses 1 through 3. So let's read 4 through 7. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes see, his eyelids test the children of man. The Lord tests the righteous, but his soul hates the wicked and the one who loves violence. Let him rain coals on the wicked. Fire and sulfur and a scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteous deeds. The upright shall behold his face. All right, so this is, as we're looking at this, David's 5 different answers as to why he takes refuge in the Lord instead of trusting in his own might. So number 1, 4A, is the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. That's a powerful answer. Because God is in control, there is absolutely nothing to be worried about. Again, they are seeing the might of the wicked. The bows are bent, the arrows are ready, we're in trouble, where David says God's in control. He can deal with those arrows, right? So you're focusing on the wrong end of the stick, some may say. And the Lord is in his holy temple. That phrase shows up every once in a while throughout the Bible. It's not extremely rare. But one of the times that shows up is in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 20. The Lord is in his holy temple. And it says, let all the earth be silent before him. So we're going to do the book of Habakkuk, chapters 1 and 2, in about 1 minute. So Habakkuk basically starts out that book by asking God, why are you not helping us? I see wickedness and violence everywhere. So why aren't you helping the righteous? And so God says, I am at work. And if I told you, you wouldn't even believe it. And I am bringing the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, to punish the wicked. Then Habakkuk has problems with that. The Chaldeans, they are more wicked than we are. So why are you using them? And God says, well, I'm going to punish them as well. So don't worry about that. I will take care of the Babylonians. And God's final answer is chapter 2, verse 22, Habakkuk. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. Chapter 3 is Habakkuk's prayer. And after hearing from God and saying, okay, the best thing I need to do is just trust in the Lord. He's got everything under control. Even though it may not look like it in my eyes, he does have everything in control. I'll just be silent before him. And then one of the most powerful passages, in my opinion, in the Old Testament is Habakkuk's final words in that prayer. Starting in verse 16, it says, I heard and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. So Habakkuk said, I am just terribly shaken, because now I get to wait for the Babylonians to come and invade. But, verse 17, though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exalt in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord God is my strength, and he has made my feet like hinds' feet and makes me walk on my high places. To me, that sounds a lot like, in the Lord, I'm going to take my refuge no matter what happens. So that's the first answer. Why should I flee to my mountain? Because the Lord is in his holy temple. And the Lord is on the throne. The Lord is king. And that should just put everything at ease. Y'all want to talk? Or should I just keep on going? What, y'all have any thoughts on that idea?
Good job.
Go ahead. Go. Keep going.
Good job.
Good job. Keep going. All right. There we go. There's my Onesiphorus, Mrs. Onesiphorus, up there, top right corner. Okay. So his second answer is the latter part of verse 4. His eyes watch, his eyelids test the sons of men. So that's going to be maybe an interesting way of saying that. His eyelids test. Well, what does that mean? And some have thought the idea of God looking really intently at something. So if something is super small print, and you just kind of squint your eyes, really, really trying to see every detail of something, that's what God is doing. He is watching. His eyelids are testing. He is examining everything very carefully. So how could David flee to his mountain when he knows God is watching him and what he's going to do? And God, that test that is happening. So maybe I always think of a child. When they know their parents are watching, they tend to behave a lot better. But when the parent maybe goes out of the room and they know he's not coming back, the door is shut, now I can do what I want to do. Well, David sees the Lord as always watching and watching very intently. I love the verse in Proverbs, the God is watching the evil and the good. So the idea there, God is watching. Why in the world would I want God to watch me flee to my mountain instead of taking refuge in him? Nothing gets by God because he sees everything. So when we keep that in mind, that is very helpful. And that takes faith to believe, okay, God's watching me. It doesn't matter if I can get away with it with man or not. I'm going to do what's right. So the first part of verse 5 is his third answer, the way we're kind of dividing this or outlining this. And it says, the Lord will test the righteous and the wicked. So again, just kind of keeping this in mind that the Lord is watching us, and maybe even more so compounded on that is the Lord is testing us. So are we going to pass the test? Are we going to pass the test, and kind of referencing our study through James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4, are those tests or trials going to produce in us patience? Let patience have its perfect work so that we may become perfect and complete, lacking nothing. So the trials, these tests, have the ability to make us more mature. So these are a blessing to us. So these are a test, and the Lord tests the righteous and the wicked. And David and maybe the other psalmist often ask God to test them. See where my heart is. See what my heart is like so that I can become better for you. I can become more mature. Chapter 7, verse 9 is one of those. Oh, let the evil of the wicked come to an end. And may you establish the righteous, you who test the minds and hearts, O righteous God. Psalm 26 in verse 2. Psalm 26 verse 2 says, prove me, O Lord, and try me. Test my heart and my mind. And then jumping all the way to the end of Psalm 139, verse 23. And this may be the one we are most familiar with. It's, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. So just the idea that's kind of duplicated many times in the Psalms of the idea of we want God to test us. We want God to see what's in our heart so that if there's something we need to work on, that something we need to tweak, we can do that. And we can become more mature. We can become stronger, better for him. I often think of Job and how that was a test for Job. And Job was much stronger in the Lord at the end of the book, even than the beginning. He was extremely righteous. God even calls him righteous at the beginning. But at the end, he recognizes who God is compared to who he is. And you just see that faith just blossom even more, grow even more through those tests and trials. So kind of the third answer, we're kind of reviewing them. One, the Lord is in his holy temple. He's on his throne. Secondly, God's eyes are watching. His eyelids are testing the sons of men. And the Lord, thirdly, tests the righteous and the wicked to improve us, to make us more mature. And then a strong argument on why you should not flee to your own mountain is the latter part of verse 5 into verse 6. And basically just saying God is against the wicked. So I don't want to be on the wrong side of the coin here. I want to be on God's side, not the side that God is going to punish. And notice how he says this, God's soul hates those who do violence. And if you think about what this psalm was about, why were they trying to get David to flee to his own mountain? Because they were trying to kill David, right? These are the violent men, the wicked, who are trying to shoot David down with the arrows. So he says, look, God's soul hates those who do violence. So by saying God's soul, David is emphasizing God hates it with all his heart. So that's not good for them. And then, depending on your version, if you're reading from the New American Standard Version, let's see, there in verse 6, it says, let him rain snares on the wicked. The ESV and other translation says, let him rain coals on the wicked, which is kind of parallel to the latter part of that verse. And there's a translation question there, what word is exactly meant. But I kind of like the idea of snares. So if you think about a snare or a trap, so he's raining down all of these traps. And what does a trap do? It kind of keeps an animal there. it can't escape out of that trap. So maybe the idea, the progression, is God is raining down all of these traps, these snares, that are catching the wicked. Now they can't go anywhere. And then what does God do next? Now that they're trapped and can't flee, then he rains down the fire, the brimstone, kind of thinking about Sodom and Gomorrah. But I kind of like that picture, whether that's right or not, I don't know. But it gets my vote. Either way, if he's raining down coals first, not snares, Same point is being made, where God will punish them, and they will not escape his punishment. And did you notice there at the very end of verse 6, rain down fire, sulfur, and the scorching wind shall be the portion of their cup? Kind of get the idea of the cup of wrath. That's mentioned several times in the prophets. I wouldn't want an ounce of that, but they get the whole cup. It's kind of the idea. So they're not going to escape God's punishment. So that's a very, very powerful argument. Knowing God is going to punish the wicked, that should encourage us not to flee to our mountain. And you can kind of see, this is where David's mindset is. So it kind of helps you understand how to read verse 1. How can you say to my soul, flee like a bird to my mountain? That's just ridiculous. Based on David's reasons on, I got 5 reasons why that's a stupid idea. And I got past history that shows me that's a dumb idea. I'm going to take refuge in the Lord. So knowing God will punish the wicked is helpful in many ways. Encourages us to stay righteous so God will not punish us. It keeps us from being intimidated by the wicked. Why would we join them when God is going to take care of them in the future and more powerful than they are? So who cares what the wicked say about us? Let's not let that intimidate us at all, because God can handle them. So that's very helpful. And then the fifth reason in verse 7, the Lord loves the righteous. God is righteous, and he loves those who are like him. And he loves them. He's going to protect them. And he says, the upright, those who are righteous, will see his face. And so you have that idea of keeping your mind on the goal of heaven, the goal of seeing God's face. And that kind of thinks about Revelation, you know, when we're there and we will get to see him face to face. That idea, the upright will see his face. And this needs to be our goal. That's our number one priority. So by keeping this in the forefront of our mind, we will keep God as our refuge no matter what. So this is a shorter psalm, but a very powerful psalm. So whenever we are tempted to flee to our mountain by someone else, or even when we're tempted to do that on our own, I'm really in big trouble here. Well, instead of trying to do things by your own might or your own wisdom, much better, David would say, to put your refuge in the Lord. So that's Psalm 11. Any thoughts or comments on that before we wrap up? Take a tea break. All right. Well, what a quiet audience you were tonight. Well, I will go ahead and close the recording. And at some point, we'll get this up on the website